welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week on Addressing Alaskans, author and energy expert Richard Heinberg. He was recorded at the Bioneers in Alaska Conference at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage on Saturday, October 16th.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our Saturday evening program. Well, I just want to ask a couple of questions. If you could, with a show of hands, how many people are attending the entire Bioneer Conference? Yahoo! Okay, so in our audience tonight, I'd like to know who has come the furthest. So just shout out.
Spinard.
That's pretty far. Yeah, that's Midtown, Anchorage. Where?
Bonita Vale, British Columbia.
Kodiak?
Kansas.
Kansas, welcome. All right. And so if I can ask, what is our oldest member in our audience?
Let's see.
No one's giving up that information. 87? 89? 90? Do I hear 100? No, kidding, yeah. Oh, well, welcome. Welcome, all of you. What's that? The youngest. Nine. One and a half. Welcome. Well, it takes all of us to make a community, so we are the community tonight. My name is Terry Brown, and I'm on the core group of Bioneers in Alaska. We are an all-volunteer group that's sole purpose is to organize this conference. We are a project. Yay! Thank you. We are a project of Alaska Center for Appropriate Technology, and this is our seventh annual conference, Creating Sustainable Communities. So it is my pleasure to introduce our keynote, Richard Heinberg, author of 9 books, including The Party's Over, Peak Everything, and the newly released Blackout. Richard Heinberg is widely regarded as one of the world's most effective communicators of the urgent need to transition away from fossil fuels. With a wry, unflinching approach based on facts and realism, Richard exposes the tenuousness of our current way of life and offers a vision for a truly sustainable future. Senior fellow in residence at Post Carbon Institute, Richard is best known as a leading educator on peak oil, the point at which we reach maximum global oil production and the resulting devastating impact it will have on our economic, food, and transportation systems. But his expertise is far-ranging, covering critical issues including the current economic crises, food and agriculture, community resilience, and global climate change. Richard's latest book, Blackout, Coal, Climate, and the Last Energy Crisis, brings critical information to the debate about coal's role as a continuing energy source in the face of climate change. Blackout sends a powerful message. With less than 20 years before U.S. coal production peaks and no viable means to produce clean coal, the need to transition entirely to renewable energy is even more critical. He's featured in many documentaries, including End of Suburbia and Leonardo DiCaprio's film 11th Hour. Richard has appeared on ABC's Good Morning America, Canadian Broadcasting Television, BBC, and Australian Broadcasting Corporation. In addition to his role with Post Carbon Institute, Richard serves on the board of PCI's sister organization, Transition US. We are very excited to have Richard speaking at our event tonight. His talk is titled, Building Resilient Communities. He will eloquently weave how the current state of affairs support the importance of creating resilient communities and how, in doing so, we will be the happier for it. So please give a warm welcome to Richard Heimberg.
Thank you so much for that warm welcome. This is my first time in Alaska, and I wish I were going to be here longer. I'll have to come back. Also, let's see what else I was. You might notice it says part one there. I will be speaking briefly tomorrow morning as well. And tomorrow morning is more about specifically what we can do in our individual lives, our families, and our communities to build resilience. This evening is more of an overview, actually. You've heard a lot of really wonderful presentations today that are inspirational. And I hope mine will not be entirely without inspiration, but I think it's weighted more toward information as opposed to inspiration. Maybe we should just get started here. The word sustainability has come up many, many times today, deservedly so. I think it is the watchword of our time. But many of us who work in the sustainability field, I think it's fair to say, share a certain concern that the word gets progressively watered down the more it's used. And in many people's minds, I think it just means something that's eco-groovy, that's less environmentally destructive than some other practice that's imaginable. But in fact, there's a lot more to sustainability. I went on a several-month journey to track down the roots of the word, and as you can see, it does have some history to it, certainly a very long history with indigenous peoples who famously, in the case of the Iroquois, made all of their decisions with the seventh generation hence in mind. But in European literature, it goes back a couple of centuries to sustainable yield forestry. After spending many weeks looking into the history of the word and how it's been used, I formulated five axioms, I call them, of sustainability, none of which is it at all original. These are just compiled from the best writing that I was able to find on the subject. Axiom one, I thought it was important to define sustainability by what happens if you don't have it, which is that the society will fail. If we're talking about a sustainable society, well, the word means what you can continue to do over time. If it's not sustainable, it's not going to last. And that comes down to instances at some point. There have been something like 24 civilizations in recorded history. There have been something like 15,000 human cultures that anthropologists have been able to identify, but only about 24 civilizations, interestingly enough, civilization being from the Latin kiwis, meaning town or city. So civilizations are cultures that develop cities and writing and usually a form of currency, money, and so on. And there have been very few of them, and with the exception of us so far, they've all tended to collapse. Something a little unsettling about that. The second axiom has to do with growth. Growth in population and rates of consumption cannot be sustained. Well, how can this be true? We've been growing our population at least, you know, certainly for the last couple of hundred years and longer than that. Well, yes, but we can't sustain any rate of growth for indefinitely. Even if we were to grow human population just at 1% per year, a few hundred years out, we would have one person for every square meter of land on the Earth's surface. At some point, natural limits would limit further population growth. And the same, obviously, with consumption. We live on a finite planet. The next axiom has to do with renewable resources. This is very simple stuff. A five-year-old can understand this principle. We can't harvest renewable resources faster than nature can replenish them. But even if it's easy to understand, evidently it's hard to put in practice because we violate this every day. We're doing it with the harvesting of fish from the ocean, with deforestation, with mining topsoil through industrial agriculture. Axiom four is maybe even a little harder to take for us industrial people because it says that there is no sustainable rate of extracting non-renewable resources, non-renewable resources being minerals and metals and fossil fuels, the very stuff of modern industrial society, the fabric of modern industrial society. So unless we're able to recycle all of those minerals and metals and stop using fossil fuels altogether, then sustainability is way, way off down the road. It's not something we can achieve by, you know, passing a resolution and you know, cleaning up a landfill or something. It's our current way of life is dramatically unsustainable, profoundly so by these axioms. And finally, you know, we can't introduce industrial wastes into the environment that cause harm. And of course, we're doing that in so many ways, but critically now with the burning of fossil fuels releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and changing climate. So these are, again, very, very simple principles. And if we want to talk about sustainability, we have to keep principles like these in mind. Now, this may not be an exhaustive list. It's possible that we could add other axioms to this list. But nevertheless, this is kind of a minimum, a bare minimum. If you can't do those things, then what you're doing is not sustainable, right? Okay, well, if we are acting unsustainably, that means that, in effect, we're in a sustainability crisis. And I believe that civilization is, in fact, in a sustainability crisis right now. And it's showing up in many, many ways. One critical way is with regard to energy. And I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about energy because energy is so important. Without energy, nothing happens. Energy in modern economic terms is just another commodity, right? We spend 8% of our GDP on energy, so that's how important it is. That is not true. Energy is everything. Without energy, nothing happens. Without energy, there is no economy. If the lights go out, if there's no fuel for cars and trucks and airplanes, the economy grinds to a halt. The economy is energy, right? So what's happened over the last couple of hundred years is something really dramatic and impressive and strange. We human beings had been living with renewable energy sources for thousands and thousands of years, using them in various ways, using wood for fuel, for heat, and food, of course, is our primary energy source. We grew crops and harvested wild foods and so on, and took that energy into our bodies and exerted energy into the environment by way of our muscles, muscle power, human muscle power, animal muscle power. We domesticated animals. All of that using sunlight, either one step removed through plants or two steps removed through animals. But what happened over the last couple of hundred years is we figured out how to use the stored solar energy of fossil fuels. And this was energy that had been concentrated over the course of millions of years through natural processes. Nature did an enormous amount of work for us in producing fossil fuels. So all we had to do was dig holes in the ground, extract these materials, and burn them and capture the energy from those fuels. And they were able, they enabled us to do things that we otherwise couldn't have done. Think about the last time you've run out of gas in your car and had to push your car off to the side of the road. You know, a ton or two of metal and glass and rubber. That's hard work. Imagine pushing your car 30 miles, let's say. That's really hard work. In fact, that's about 6 or 8 weeks of hard human labor. We get that from a single gallon of gasoline, for which we pay in California. I don't know what you're paying here. In California, we pay like a little over $2, and or about $3 right now, a little over $3. And complain, right? So that's 6 or 8 weeks of hard human labor's worth of energy for which we're paying $3. You can't get labor that cheap in China or anywhere else. So of course we've mechanized everything we possibly could over the course of the last couple of centuries to take advantage of this economic miracle of fossil fuels. Now, of course, fossil fuels are non-renewable, so in principle, they're running out every time we extract them from the earth and burn them, right? And the first person to really understand that process of oil depletion was this gentleman right here, Marion King Hubbert, or M. King Hubbert, who was probably the most important geophysicist of the 20th century. And he famously forecast, all the way back in 1956, that U.S. oil production would reach a peak and begin to decline around 1970. Now, this was important because at that time, the U.S. was the epicenter of the world oil industry. In any given year, more than half the world's oil was being produced in the U.S. in the early part of the 20th century. In the early part of the 20th century, before World War II, the U.S. was also the world's foremost oil exporting nation. This is where the automobile industry took root. It's where aviation started. We became the world's economic powerhouse because we had the cheap oil and the technology with which to use it. So to say, as Hubbert did in 1956, that U.S. oil production would peak and begin to decline in just a few years, this was heresy, particularly for a man who was working for an oil company. And he was implored by other geologists and by his colleagues at Shell not to come forward publicly with this forecast, but of course he did it anyway. This is what the U.S. was like at one point, right? We were getting rich from oil, and finding it in our backyards, right? Not anymore. This is Hubbert's 1956 hand-drawn graph of what he thought oil depletion in the U.S. would look like. You have to find it before you produce it, and U.S. oil discoveries had been declining since the early 1930s, so he reasoned that U.S. oil production would start to decline somewhere around 1970, and that's exactly what happened. Since 1970, the U.S. has been a post-peak oil country. We have been importing more and more oil from other countries. Now, this is just the lower 48 states. If we add on Alaska, we get a little bump on the side, North Slope of Alaska, remember that? At its peak rate of flow, a couple of million barrels per day. Now it's down to, what, 600,000 or 700,000 barrels per day, 700,000. add in the Gulf of Mexico. We get another little bump off to the side on the way down. What happens if we bring on Anwar and coastal California and the rest of the Gulf of Mexico and all of the off-limits areas in the U.S., we get another little bump off to the side on our way down. It doesn't bring us back up to peak levels of production again. It's just another little respite in the process of depletion and decline that we're inexorably on. This is the world situation. Remember, in the U.S., discoveries peaked in 1930, production peaked in 1970, so there's a 40-year time lag between discovery peak and production peak. Globally, discoveries of oil have been declining since around 1964, so that's more than 40 years ago. So that's a clue that world oil production may be close to its all-time maximum. Now, the U.S. is not the only country to have reached peak oil production. It's part of a growing club. It was the original member, the charter member of a growing club that now includes Indonesia, Norway, Great Britain, Oman, and many others. Most oil-producing countries, in fact, now are seeing declining production. This is what actual world crude oil production has looked like for the last few years, and you'll notice it's reached a kind of plateau, which is significant because oil prices have been going crazy. You know, back in 1998, oil was selling for $12 a barrel. Let's adjust that for inflation and call it $18 a barrel. Let's round it off and call it $20 a barrel. In 1998-2000, the U.S. Department of Energy, the International Energy Agency, all the responsible agencies were saying that in 2010, oil would cost $20 a barrel. And in the worst case scenario, it might get up to $40 a barrel. What is it actually right now? It's north of $80 a barrel. And yet, even with these very high prices, we see production not even budging since 2005. Why is that? Well, that's because the oil business has changed. See, we used to find oil in situations like this. This is what the oil business looked like in 1859. This is what the oil business looks like today. We're looking for oil under a mile or two or three of ocean water, or in Arctic environments, or in African countries that are politically unstable, that may not even have functioning governments, where it's very, very risky for oil companies to operate. Why is this? Well, it's because of the low-hanging fruit principle of resource extraction. And this is true not just for oil, it's true for coal and natural gas and iron and yttrium and, you know, any mineral or metal or fossil fuel you can name. We go after the cheap, easy, high-quality stuff first and leave the nasty, low-quality, hard-to-get stuff for later. And with regard to oil, guess what? It's later. We've run out the cheap oil. It's not to say that we're running out of oil in an absolute sense, that there's no more petroleum on Earth. Far from it. In fact, the optimists point out that world oil reserves are higher today than they've ever been. And that's true. But reality check here. What was happening in the United States in 1970? In 1970, U.S. oil reserves were higher than they had ever been, and that was the year that U.S. oil production peaked. So the size of reserves is not a clue. What's actually happened is over the past several decades, we've been replacing reserves of light, sweet, easy-to-get-out crude with heavy, sour, hard-to-get crude. So reserves may be large, but what's left is oil that's going to be slow to produce, expensive to produce, and the rate of oil production, which is what we're talking about, is not going to be able to grow. Now, this idea of peak oil has been, up to recent times, considered kind of a fringe idea. And in fact, organizations like ExxonMobil have taken out ad space in the New York Times to make fun of it and say, well, of course, there can't be anything to that. But behind the scenes, military organizations in the U.S. and in Europe, intelligence organizations, oil analytics firms take this very, very seriously. Why? Because we have a society that depends on oil for over 90% of its transport energy, something like actually over 95% of our transport energy. What would life in Alaska look like without oil? And I'm not just talking about the economy of Alaska, the money that's made from producing oil and shipping it south. I mean, what would life look like without oil, without gasoline to put in the tanks of your cars? Trucks, without airplanes. I got a call about a year and a half ago picked up the phone, and the voice on the other end said, "Hello, this is Charles Schlumberger from the World Bank." And I said, "Well, what's this?" I don't often get calls from the World Bank, and I don't often get calls from somebody named Schlumberger. Schlumberger, if you don't know, that's the name of a huge oil services company. Turns out that Charles Schlumberger is from that family, but rather than going into the oil services company, he went into the World Bank instead, and he heads the air transport sector. So he had read something about peak oil, and he thought, well, maybe this could impact world aviation, and he ought to check it out. So he gave me a call, and I said, "Yeah, I think this is something you should check out. You should, you know, look into it a little further." He has since gone on to not only to research it, but to write papers about it and so on. Unfortunately, the World Bank refuses to publish his papers on peak oil, so he has to publish them through McGill University. But he is convinced that aviation basically has no future. You know, there are alternative fuels to put in airplanes, biofuels, they'll have to be, you know, very highly refined synthetic biofuels. They're going to be very, very expensive, and the quantities available will be very, very limited. So we are looking at a dying industry here. We could talk about automobiles and all the rest, but at this point in the discussion, somebody typically is sitting in their seat going, "Yeah, but we have 250 years worth of coal, right?" I'm going to go through this really quickly because I know that you in Alaska do not get very much of your energy from coal. So this may not be a cause for great concern. Really? You do? Okay, I was misinformed. Well, let me talk about it then. Coal is the world's fastest growing energy source by quantity. We know that wind is growing fast on a percentage basis. Solar is growing at great guns on a percentage basis. But the amount that coal grows in a typical year over, say, the last 5 years, just that growth in coal energy is more than all of the energy we're currently getting from solar and wind put together. And where is it growing? Guess, China. And of course, coal is the most carbon intensive of the fossil fuels. So unless we deal with coal, we're not going to be able to do anything about global climate change. And what do we use coal for? Well, of course, we use it mostly for electricity production in the US, also for making steel, a number of other uses, particularly in China. But here in the US, we use a heck of a lot of it just for making coal. Very, very briefly, resources refer to the total amount of stuff in the ground. Reserves refer to how much of the resource we believe that we'll be able to get out of the ground economically. Okay? And there are always restrictions on reserves. Now, this is true not just with coal, but also with other fossil fuels and other non-renewables that we mine. Restrictions like how deep is the stuff buried, how thick is the seam, the coal seam, let's say, what are the impurities, what's the resource quality. And the thing is, as we take more of those restrictions into account, the reserves tend to decline. And this is what's happened with coal. The U.S. is working with old surveys of coal resources and reserves going back to the 1970s. And then what we do is we take that reserve number and we divide it by annual production. We get a reserve to production ratio. And then somebody looks at that number and says, well, that's meant how many years of coal we have. That's completely misleading. And every time you hear that we have so many years worth of a particular resource, I hope a little light bulb goes on in your head and you say, wait a minute, that's not true, because it's not. It's never true. Reserve to production ratios are always misleading. Why? Because we never use any resource at a constant rate until one day it runs out. What happens instead is we start from zero, we reach a peak of production, and once the cheap, easy stuff, the low-hanging fruit is gone, we reach a peak of production, production gradually declines. What we need to know for economic purposes is when are we going to reach the end of the cheap, easy stuff? And with regard to coal, it's not going to be 250 years from now. Okay, this is where the coal is. Yes, Alaska definitely has coal and is going to be exporting more and more of that to China. I'll be talking a little bit more about that in just a second. You know, the first survey of coal in the U.S. back in 1907, 1905, 1907, said that we had 5,000 years worth of coal. And in the surveys that were done in the 1970s said that we had 250 to 270 years worth. So what happened to that 4,700 years worth of coal? Did somebody just misplace it? Is it under the sofa cushions? No, what happened is geologists took into account more restrictions. Now, the same process is happening. The U.S. Geological Survey has not issued a new updated survey of the country as a whole, as it promised to do back in 1995. But all indications are that U.S. coal production will peak within probably the next, certainly the next 20 years, but I think even that forecast may be too optimistic. I would suggest U.S. energy from coal in the U.S. may already have peaked. These are the trends in U.S. coal production. Basically, we've already reached the end of the cheap, easy stuff in the eastern part of the country, the high-quality coal, and we're relying more and more on low-quality coal primarily from Wyoming. And even though Wyoming coal production has increased sharply over the last 30 years, those very productive, mostly surface mines are being mined out very, very rapidly. The heating value of coal is declining. What does that mean? It means we're mining more of the stuff and getting less energy out of it because of declining resource quality. Now, one study done in 2007 by an analytics organization in Germany forecast U.S. coal production peak around 2025, 2030. A more recent survey suggests U.S. coal production energy from coal peaking already. So when you hear this, that we have 250 years worth of coal, I hope that you'll realize that's not even wrong. You know, if we could say instead, well, we have 100 years worth of coal or 50 years worth of coal, then it would at least be wrong. But the whole framing of the statement is misleading and disinformative. So how about the world? Well, when we're talking about world coal, we're really talking about China. China is currently using 3 billion tons of coal per year. That's three times as much as the U.S. China is using almost half of the coal burned in the entire world right now. And China's economy has grown over the past decade, two decades, almost entirely as a result of coal consumption. But because China's reserves are smaller than those of the U.S., China's coal production peak is going to be a sharp peak, and the decline is going to be very rapid. What that means is China is going to start importing more coal from the rest of the world, including Alaska, but also Australia, Indonesia, Russia. And China is going to absorb all available coal exports very rapidly. Even 3 years of coal consumption growth at current rates, China would absorb all available global exports. So what's that going to do for the price of coal globally? It's going to make it shoot up. India is also wanting to import the same coal. So this means even if the world has another 10 or 20 years before its coal production peak, which is optimistic at this point, I would say, because this is an older, this is a 2007 survey. The latest information is world coal production may be peaking effectively next year. The implications are almost as scary as those for global oil production peak. Electricity is extremely important. It's as important for modern industrial life as oil.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with author and energy expert Richard Heinberg. He was recorded at the Bioneers in Alaska annual conference in Anchorage on October 16th.
We hear in this country so much about clean coal, and the coal industry, of course, is behind this very, very well-funded public relations effort to sell us on the idea that coal can be clean. Well, first of all, coal can't be clean because the very process of mining it destroys mining communities and ecosystems and the lives of the families of miners. But even taking in, you know, forgetting that, can't we just take the carbon dioxide that would ordinarily go into the atmosphere and capture that and bury it in deep caverns in the ground? Yes. It's technologically possible. We're even already doing all of the elements of that system in one way or another. We're using CO2 to inject into oil wells to force the oil toward boreholes to make oil production more productive. But if we were to develop carbon capture and storage on a massive scale so that it actually was making a difference to global greenhouse gas emissions, the scale of the effort would be unbelievable. And every energy expert knows that this would add substantially to the price of electricity. But these same energy experts are assuming that coal is abundant and cheap, and it always will be, so it might just work. Right? You can just barely make those cost equations work, but add in higher prices of coal and it absolutely doesn't work. Not only would the price of coal-based electricity be so high as to undercut economic growth, it would certainly be high enough that any other source of electricity would be cheaper by comparison. So, spending money on coal, even clean coal, makes no economic sense at this point. New coal power plants are a bad idea, not only from an environmental point of view, but an economic point of view. And this is something that our country needs to wake up to very, very quickly. So, where are we? We're at peak oil, basically, now. We're at peak coal, basically, now. What about natural gas? We hear these great things about unconventional natural gas, fracking, non-porous reservoirs of natural gas can now be opened up with chemicals and, you know, forcing water and steam underground and explosives and cracking the rock and fracturing the rock so that it liberates the natural gas. And we have 100 years worth of natural gas now, we're being told. Hang on a second. Wait. What were we just talking about? Almost certainly, this unconventional gas is being hyped by the companies that are making money not from producing unconventional gas, but from investment. This is what's going on. None of these companies, whether we're talking about Chesapeake or Devon, none of these companies are actually making money on gas production. They're drilling and they're producing gas so they can attract more investment. And they're subsisting on investment capital. Why? Because it's so damn expensive to produce this unconventional gas. Is the gas there? Yes. But what's the resource quality? What's the energy return on the energy that's invested in producing? It's very low. So that means that until we have much higher natural gas prices, this doesn't make sense. And even with higher natural gas prices, it's going to be very problematic because these are very rapidly depleting wells. And what we're seeing, in effect, is another bubble. Like the high-tech or internet bubble of the late 90s, or the real estate bubble, the mortgage-backed securities bubble of the last few years. Now we're in the midst of a unconventional gas bubble, and it's going to play out very rapidly. Well, what else is there? Biofuels haven't turned out so well so far, and I wouldn't expect that much more from them, quite frankly. Are we at the dawn of a nuclear renaissance? not likely there either because of the need for such enormous investment capital. And right now, have you noticed we're in kind of a credit crisis? So even nuclear power plants that were already on the drawing boards for the U.S. just 2 years ago are being canceled because the investment climate is so bad. So what's left? Well, other renewable energy sources like solar and wind that we already knew about, certainly, but dramatic energy conservation. And this is the one nobody wants to talk about. You know, it's all about how can we continue to use as much energy as we're using right now, but just get it from some other place. It's not going to happen. You know, our organization did a study last year. And it's published on our website. You can download it for free as a PDF. It's like 75 or 80 pages long. It's called Searching for a Miracle. What we did was to take 18 different energy sources and analyze them with 10 criteria, including these, and look at them to see what combination of alternative energy sources could make up for fossil fuels as fossil fuels deplete and as we turn away from them in order to protect the global climate. Our conclusion from that study is that we could identify no credible scenario in which alternative energy sources can be scaled up fast enough to make up for fossil fuels as the latter decline. We will have less energy in the future. So, what we should be doing right now is figuring out how to live perfectly acceptable, happy lives with less energy. And that shouldn't be that hard. Folks in Europe are already using half as much energy as Americans and living perfectly happy, acceptable lives. And people in other parts of the world, even much less. Now, granted, there are still some very serious problems that we have to address. Peak oil effectively probably means peak food because we've waited too long to make the transition to an organic, non-fossil fuel food system. It certainly can be done. We have all of the examples, but the reality is that the vast majority of the national and world food system is extremely petroleum dependent and fossil fuel dependent currently. And as fossil fuels become more expensive, as the price of oil goes up, that puts pressure on farmers. It's going to make it very, very difficult to expand the food supply, especially in the face of climate change and limits to water. We're losing something like 24, 25 billion tons of topsoil every year. This can't go on. Problems with fresh water, obviously, I can't talk about any of these subjects in nearly as much detail as energy, but aquifers depleting, rivers drying up, glaciers, snowpack disappearing. Minerals and metals, same situation as fossil fuels, non-renewable resources. These are just ones that we use in the computer industry and the renewable energy industry. The big electromagnets for wind turbines are made with rare earth elements. And where do we get rare earth elements? 97% come from China. China is saying now, well, we have a corner on the market. Maybe we should curb exports of rare earth elements. They're making contradictory statements. One week they say, we're going to stop exporting rare earths. Next week they say, oh, no, we're not going to do that. But this is some indication of where we're going. We're going to more and more global competition for dwindling supplies of both renewable and non-renewable resources. Phosphate rock is very important for what? Modern industrial agriculture. It's essential for plant growth. Now, the way to get around this, of course, is nutrient recycling. If instead of sending our human wastes in, you know, through sewage treatment plants and out into the into rivers and ultimately into oceans and dead zones, if we were to recycle all of those wastes back into the soil, then we would do away with the need for importing phosphate rock that has to be mined and which is depleting very rapidly. But until we do that, we have a problem on our hands. And that problem is exacerbated by the fact that there are more of us wanting to use these depleting resources, whether it's water or topsoil or fossil fuels or other sources of energy. We're almost up to 7 billion of us now, and adding another 70 million with each passing year. And as there are more people using more resources and building more cities and parking lots and roads, we're taking up habitat that used to be habitat for other species. And we just found out over the last couple of weeks that almost a third of all plant species are now threatened. I'm not going to talk to you about climate after you've heard from Jim Hansen, the world expert on that subject. But there's a relationship here that goes all the way through, from fossil fuels to population to water to climate to the economy. What's the relationship with the economy? Well, the economy, you know, from one standpoint, it looks like we've done miracles, right? Look at GDP growth just in the last century. Off the charts, right? Per capita GDP. How did we do that? With cheap fossil fuels. You look around and you can find J curves that look like that all over the place. Population, number of motor vehicles, number of McDonald's restaurants. You know, we could have 20, 30, 100 of these kinds of graphs, and they'd all look the same, basically. Well, as this was happening, as we were developing an economy based on cheap fossil fuels and cheap energy from fossil fuels, we were also developing economic theories, what we call the science of economics. And so economists were looking around and watching all of this amazing economic, fossil-fueled economic growth and saying, well, this is normal. This is the working of the free market. This is what we should expect to happen in perpetuity. And so we designed our financial systems on the basis of the assumption that growth is normal and natural and it can go on forever. And so we designed those financial systems also so that if growth were to stop, then there would be hell to pay. There would be economic and financial catastrophe. But of course, we don't have to worry about that because growth is normal and natural and it's going to go on forever. Well, we institutionalized growth, for example, in fractional reserve banking, in the leveraging of debt. So growth has become necessary to the monetary health of nations. And what happens when growth stops? We're finding out just since 2008. Now, a connection back with energy once again. Remember in 2008 when the price of oil spiked up to almost $150 a barrel? You know, oil was getting more expensive anyway because it was getting more expensive to produce and supply wasn't increasing. So speculators piled on and were investing in oil futures, and that drove the price sky high up to a record $150 a barrel. Well, every time we have an oil price spike, those vertical gray bars, those are historic recessions. And you notice almost every one of them, there's an exception over here around the early 2000s, but otherwise, every recession since 1970 has been heralded by an oil price spike. So seeing in 2008 that the oil price was shooting up to $150 a barrel, any economist worth her or his salt should have anticipated the worst recession since World War II, which is exactly what we got. Now, is that to say that the recession was and is being caused by high oil prices only? No. There were other factors at play. The real estate bubble, the derivatives market, all of these were a house of cards that was set up. And then the oil price spike came along and triggered that house of cards to fall over. Something like $50 trillion vanished over the course of 2008. Now, we know that there have been enormous stimulus packages and bailout programs and so on. Something on the order of $13 trillion just in this country alone of guarantees and stimulus packages and bailouts. But compared to the $50 trillion that vanished over the course of 2008, that's still, well, it's maybe more than a drop in the bucket. But do you see why we're still facing an enormous economic uphill battle to grow jobs, to grow the economy. Well, in fact, what's happened, I believe, is that we have hit the limits to growth. You know, this was the best-selling environmental book of all time. Came out in 1972. It was the first instance of using computer programs to model population growth and resource depletion. And they came to the conclusion that economic growth would end sometime in the early 21st century. Not only were they right, I believe that we have hit those limits to growth in the form of peak oil and in the form of peak debt. And we will never see economic activity in this country, certainly, and probably for the world as a whole, higher than it was in 2007. That's not to say that we won't see one quarter of economic growth in relation to the previous quarter, or that one country won't grow relative to another country. Certainly China is still doing very well right now, apparently. But overall, I think we've hit the limits. And that has enormous implications for the rest of our lives, because we've all grown up in a certain economic environment where every year we anticipated more, bigger, faster. And from now on, it's going to be less, smaller, and slower. Until we get to a point where our society actually is sustainable, where we can operate our society on the basis of renewable resources extracted at the rates that nature can replenish them. It's inevitable. It will happen. It's just a question of whether we plan for it or not, and you know, how much fun we have on the way down. So, and all of this is scary stuff. Believe me, I lose sleep over all of this, and I worry sometimes about whether to tell people this information, quite frankly, because it can be toxic information. If I'm telling you this stuff and you don't do anything about it, you are going to suffer as a result. You are going to lose sleep, even if you try to deny it, even if you think, well, he must be, you know, whatever drug he's on, I don't want any of it. Forget it, I'm gonna, you know, go play golf and not think about it anymore. This information has entered your brain and it's not going to go away. The only way for you to deal with it psychologically is to do something about it. Quite frankly, it's the only thing that keeps me as sane as I am. Okay. No, this is not what to do. Well, actually, in fact, I think we all do need to do some of this. We all should be experiencing some grief and mourning because we are living in a world that is in a great deal of pain right now. Not just the human world, but also the non-human world. And so if we're not feeling some of that, we're not really alive, or we're not being honest with ourselves. But don't stay there. Don't just stay there. We need to be working at every level that we possibly can to make a difference in this enormous transition that is going to last through the remainder of our lifetimes, regardless of how old we are, whether we're 5 years old or 95 years old. This shift, this transition, is going to be happening at our at the personal level, with our families, with our communities, and at the national level and international level. And we need to be thinking about what we can do at each of those levels to make a difference. You know, every time you get in an airplane, they say adjust your own oxygen mask first before you help those around you. Well, think of that too with regard to doing something about all of this stuff. If you're not making those changes in your own life first, then, you know, getting up in front of the city council or telling your neighbors, your voice rings a little bit hollow, right? It doesn't carry much authority. But if you're doing everything you can in your personal life and with your family, then you really have something to stand on. Now, A bit of good news here is that, in a way, all of this is kind of simple. Because fossil fuels are really at the center of so many of the problems that we've been talking about. Whether it's climate change and greenhouse gases, or we heard about chemicals this afternoon. Well, most of the chemicals produced in the chemicals industry are chemicals made from organic compounds, and most of those are made from fossil fuels. Natural gas, very often, sometimes oil. If we can solve this one problem, if we can reduce our dependence on oil, if we can get off of fossil fuels, we will have solved an enormous range of environmental, social, and economic problems facing us as a species. So if we can just focus on that one thing, it simplifies so much. We need to have a goal in mind. And I don't think realistically, as I said earlier, our goal should be to replace fossil fuels on a one-to-one basis so that we're continuing to use as much energy as we are now, but it's just coming from wind turbines and solar panels. Quite frankly, I think that's extremely unlikely to happen for a number of reasons. If you want to get the full story, read that PDF I was talking about, the Searching for a Miracle report. This is probably a more realistic view of what the future could look like, a transition away from fossil fuels to renewables, using energy at a much lower rate, but at a constant and sustainable rate. If we have that as our goal, I think that's realistic. This energy transition that I've been talking about, it's inevitable. Climate change tells us that it's necessary from an ethical and moral point of view. But the reality is it's going to happen anyway. So just from the standpoint of naked self-interest, it's in all of our interest to find ways to get off of fossil fuels as quickly as possible. Obviously, substituting energy sources wherever possible, but relocalizing economic activity. Why? Because the more we rely on a globalized system of production and distribution, the more brittle that system is, and the more it's likely to break down. So the more we can produce locally, it's not just a matter of burning less fossil fuels in order to, reduce the climate impact. We also have to think about, how dependent we are on systems that are going to break down. And transportation is one of those systems. Making our food less oil intensive and less oil dependent. And again, there's a report on our postcarbon.org website called The Food and Farming Transition that goes into much more detail than I could possibly do tonight about how we can accomplish this and what the excellent examples are that are already out there. Transportation, the first thing we have to do with transportation is reduce our need for it. Because no matter what we do in terms of substituting transport modes, we are going to be less mobile in the future than we are currently. Transportation is going to be slower, and there's going to be less of it available. So if you want to be living close to your family, now's the time to be thinking about that. Don't put off that decision. Okay, every talk like this has to end with a mandatory message of hope. So just to be a contrarian, I have to tell you, quite frankly, I don't think there is any hope for business as usual, perpetual growth, or normal life as we've come to know it, as consumerist Americans. And maybe that is the good news, because normal life as we've come to know it, perpetual growth, and business as usual are killing the planet and killing our spirits. So it's high time we invent something else. We do have hard times ahead of us because of the economy, because of declining energy supplies, because we've put off this transition too long. You know, if we'd started back in the 1970s and kept up with it, we'd be in a much better place right now, but that's not an option anymore. Here we are now. It's going to be a forced march. We're going to have to do this rapidly. We're going to have to do it under circumstances of some duress. But people have lived in hard times before. You know, we pampered baby boomer Americans. I guess I can't speak for everyone as being baby boomers here tonight, but I can speak for my generation. We have grown up in the most affluent country under the most stable political and economic conditions of any generation in the history of our species. So if we have some hard times ahead of us, well, is that going to cause us to fall into a puddle of, you know, despair? Well, think about what people went through in the Great Depression or World War II or any number of hard times that have existed before. People came together, they sacrificed, they made the best of it, and in many cases afterward, they looked back and they said those were good times because they drew on the best of what we had inside us, and they made us work hard, and we were proud of what we did afterward. Okay? I think how we talk about this is very important. I have talked to you all in a really straightforward way tonight, and I'm glad to be able to do that because I think you can take it. You're smart enough people, you've been prepared by lots of other information to be able to hear it in a pretty flat-out way. A lot of people are not able to do that right off the bat. They immediately turn off, they go to sleep, they go into denial. So it's important that we tailor our message, that we also emphasize the benefits that can come as we emphasize not just, you know, we've counted economic growth as the almost the sole good that we can produce as a society, right? Since economic growth is no longer available, we have to find other things to aim for, like gross national happiness. You know, and if we do that, if we find things to aim for and to measure that really make sense and that are connected to our genuine human welfare, then we can have a better future. We can make progress of a different kind. We can have cultural achievements and qualities of health and education that really would put our current national situation to shame on the basis of much lower levels of resource and energy consumption. So let's do it. Okay. Finally, you know, when I travel and come to a place I've never been before, I'm always extremely excited to meet people who are already doing amazing things. You know, the Bioneers Conference originates in California, in San Rafael. My wife Janet and I went to our first Bioneers Conference in 1992. We've been to, I don't know how many, 15 or 18 of them, something like that. And people look to California and say, oh, all the groovy stuff is happening there. Don't believe it. It's not true. There is so much going on in every part of this country and the world, and it in many ways puts what's happening in at least my corner of California to shame. So find if you're, I already know that there are many of you who are already engaged in amazing projects here in Alaska. If you're just kind of getting a start in all of this, look around you, have some conversations, find people in your area who are already doing these things and get involved. The sustainability revolution will be driven by crisis. But remember, crisis is opportunity. And we're going to have the biggest opportunity of our lifetimes. So thank you very much.
Yeah. You've been listening to author and energy expert Richard Heinberg on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. You can listen to the question and answer portion of the program, which immediately followed Richard's talk, on our website, kska.org. Richard Heinberg speaking on Building Resilient Communities was recorded at the annual Bioneers in Alaska Conference in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on Saturday, October 16th, 2010.
I just want to emphasize, please give me your question.
I've been admonished to make this question precise and brief. I don't know if I can do that or not. You showed a graph up there in which you were conceiving of how the energy production mix would be in the future, and you showed a sustainable level in there, and I wonder, have you tried to quantify that in any way, and then what's your basis for that value, if you have one? Thanks.
Yeah, you know, we actually haven't done that. That slide is from a colleague of mine named Paul Mobbs, who's a British energy activist and analyst. And I've seen that slide criticized on a number of scores, but at least, you know, it's a jumping off point for discussion. My guess is that we Americans probably are going to see a decline in available energy of something probably more than 75% when all said and done. And that's going to be a difficult thing to adjust to, but it's not going to happen all at once. It's going to be a process. It's going to be partially market mediated. In other words, the prices of energy will get higher and higher, and people will just find ways to do with less. But the decline is going to be substantial because we're 85% dependent on fossil fuels currently, coal, oil, and natural gas in this country. And so it's going to take a lot of investment and a lot of time to make that switch over to alternative sources.
Well, that kind of gets around to my question a little bit too. I noticed it was 3.5 years ago, traveling by train in China, the number of cooling towers, and it seemed like it was sometimes one community after the next, especially between Beijing and back to Hong Kong. I'm wondering, are they going more toward nuclear than we are, and why?
Yes. Well, China is going in every direction at once. It's building more renewable energy capacity than any other country. It's building more coal capacity than any other country. It's building more nuclear than any other country. It's building more of everything than any other country. Highways, new cars, shopping malls, even if they're deserted, they're building them. And this is another bubble. You know, once you understand what bubbles are, they're pretty easy to see. And China is a bubble economy right now. I actually have an essay called The China Coal Bubble that's up on the internet. A smaller version of that is going to be published as an op-ed in Nature magazine in a few weeks.
The bubble is
coal, but it's also real estate. It's the basic economic model that that China is using with which to develop, and it can't go on much longer. Quite simply.
So I've been aware of some work by a guy named David Bloom, and I wanted to check. You know his name, and so. Because he doesn't claim, because he's a permaculturist doing biofuels in a different way, and so he doesn't make claims about, you know, continuing our insane way of living. But I want to know what you think about him, because when I tried to look into his stuff, it looked like it was pretty sane.
Yeah, if you're going to make biofuels, make them the way David Bloom does. I think he's done some great work in that regard. I think sometimes he gives his audiences the sense that you know, as a nation or for the world as a whole, we'll be able to carry on with more of a semblance of business as usual with biofuels. But you know, I haven't heard him speak for about 3 years, so maybe that's changed.
Okay, you know, my sense is he gives that impression, but in the book, that's one of the myths.
Yeah,
one of
good.
The myths to debunk is, oh, we can keep doing what we're doing.
Good, good. Okay. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about the coal in Alaska. A lot of that coal is really close to Anchorage, and a lot of us live in the communities that are likely to be impacted by the increased export of Alaska's coal. I'm wondering if you see any hope for us being able to keep that coal in the ground, and if you have any ideas on how we might tip the balance to leave it in the ground.
Well, I think some good old-fashioned activism is in order. And you know, Jim Hansen has led the way on that. Here's a man who is a world acclaimed scientist, and yet he these days is just as often to be found on picket lines as he is in a laboratory. So I think that says something to the rest of us. You know, if we want to stop a coal power plant or if we want to stop a coal mine, we have to become smart community organizers. I don't remember her name, but the woman who we saw earlier this afternoon, brilliant community organizer. That kind of savvy and understanding needs to be brought to the table. That coal should stay in the ground.
In the last day or two, there's been an article widely linked to from places like Energy Bulletin about how the U.S. military is preparing for peak oil, but there doesn't seem to be any program at all to bring this news or any kind of preparation to civilians.
That's correct.
Do you think the federal plan is to throw us under the bus?
No, quite frankly, I don't think there is a federal plan. You know, I've been on this subject for years, and I've spoken to many elected officials, and I've spoken to people in military intelligence, and I've spoken to non-elected appointed officials in various related departments, U.S. Geological Survey, and so on. And I haven't talked to a single one yet who has confirmed to me that there is some kind of behind-the-scenes plan to deal with peak oil. I think, quite frankly, that most government agencies are run by people with educations in either economics or political science, and those are educations that do not prepare one to understand the subject of resource depletion. Economists believe that we can never run out of any resource because the market will always find a substitute. And political scientists are only concerned about, you know, how to compete for access to resources. The geologists that I talk to who work for USGS or US Department of Energy and who do understand this stuff say, you know, they talk till they're blue in the face and there's, you know, the higher ups just don't listen or they find that it's maybe just not good for them as a career move to even talk about it very much. So I'm sure there are people in the U.S. government who have some understanding of this, but as you say, in the military, there aren't those same kinds of political blinders on for some reason. There is a more pragmatic view of the situation, partly because the military is so incredibly dependent on oil for all of its operations, and you know, just from a strategic point of view, they want to know, you know, are we going to be able to continue flying our Predator drones? Will we have enough fuel for them? I hope not, but that's another subject. I could be wrong, but my conclusion from the conversations I've had is that there is some awareness within the military, but there's very, very little in other departments of government.
I'd like to make a remark about, you haven't sped much about hydropower. Hydropower in Alaska is enormous. I worked for the Corps of Engineers, and there was a man by the name of Reuben Hack, who originally did the surveys on the Columbia River. And they told him he was crazy when he said that the Columbia River was going to be developed in his lifetime. Well, they were wrong, and the Columbia River has developed enormous power. He surveyed all of Alaska and the prospective hydroelectric sites in Alaska, and they are enormous. Mm-hmm. And they are a lot of the sites that are being talked about now to provide power for Alaska are relatively small compared to the other sites that are enormous, like Rampart and the Copper River and other places on the Yukon that are enormous. And Alaska really in the future has an enormous capacity for future electric power.
Right. You're absolutely right about that. And I think it would be an environmental tragedy if enormous numbers of giant dams were built to take advantage of that potential. Alaska, because of its enormous hydro potential but small population, has a tremendous opportunity to become self-sufficient in electricity from micro hydro, which is much, much less damaging to watersheds and wildlife. So this is something that should be looked into. There are many opportunities for Alaska to develop renewable energy. And so, go for it.
Thanks for coming up here. You made reference to the being of the baby boomer age when your generation and those several after you have not really ever known hardship, and that basically it's time for us to kind of suck it up as things get more difficult, which I think is a good message. What I'm wondering about is most people think that it's those already on the margins that are going to suffer the most when the changes come. And I'm wondering how you, in your own thinking, balance the victory garden route, the make our own communities tight and sustainable, with what we owe to the rest of the world as the first pusher, mm-hmm. and looking out for those who maybe are already living a lot more desperately than we have yet.
Right. Well, within the U.S., we desperately need some means of equalizing wealth. Not complete equalization, not, you know, everybody gets the same paycheck every week or anything like that, but we have the wealth inequality in this country is at truly societally damaging levels. When you have a very, very tiny minority who control such a great proportion of wealth, the last time we had wealth inequality like this in this country was 1929. Which tells you something right there. So whether it's through more progressive taxation, whether it's, you know, there are lots of ways of accomplishing the same thing, but somehow we have to make sure that as the economy weakens, as prices of commodities and energy go up, that large numbers of people don't just fall off the table, because if we don't do something different from what we're doing right now, that's exactly what's going to happen, and it's going to create political chaos in this country, and we will be ripe for takeover by charlatans and demagogues. Okay. Now, as for the rest of the world, morally, ethically, a very good case can be made that the United States owes much of the rest of the world a very great deal, that we have plundered less industrialized countries of their resources and cheap labor and so on. realistically, politically, I think it's, at this point in time, it's almost inconceivable that we could make some kind of reparations for that, because we will be going through an economic transition of our own that's going to be very, very difficult as it is. What we could do is provide an example by powering down in a peaceful and proactive and cooperative way. And we could also provide technology, provide appropriate technology and renewable technology to less industrialized nations free of intellectual property rights. And that's what we should do.
First of all, thank you. I had a question concerning vicious and virtuous cycles. They're the same process makes a vicious cycle become a virtuous cycle, and that causes one to think that change can happen quicker.
Right.
So what type of thinking have you done with shifting those cycles to a virtuous cycle, understanding that that's very optimistic and doable?
Right. Well, I think that could happen in the best instance as we get off of fossil fuels. I think the process of getting off of the one thing we have to do to get past the worst bit is reform our financial system. And it may seem like a whole different subject. I mean, we're talking about the environment, we're talking about natural resources and energy and so on. What does the financial system have to do with it? Well, the problem is the financial system is set to work only in conditions of economic growth. And as the period of economic growth comes to an end, if we don't do something to redesign our financial system, we are going to experience the mother of all economic catastrophes in this country. And I think we're, skating on the very edge of that right now. So we have to reform how money is created in this country. We have to reform what banks are and how banks operate. The whole system of money and finance has to be rethought. That's really primary. It's absolutely essential. And then if we do that, and then at the same time, if we start to proactively and in a systematic way get off of fossil fuels, I think we will see a lot of virtuous cycles kick in with a different kind of economy. I think we could see patterns of employment and work that would actually be a lot more sensible and fulfilling for people, less, of this country, just depending on financialization of the economy and selling real estate and all of this in order to prop up the economy, and more people actually doing real fulfilling work that involves skills and enjoyable labor. We could use 50 million new farmers just as for a start, right? But we have to have an economy, a financial system that supports that, and right now it discourages it. So if we can make some basic reforms, I think, in fact, the process of adaptation could become a kind of virtuous cycle.
Let's have a few questions from this side real quick. Thanks.
Yeah.
You've written quite a bit about the limitations of wind and solar in terms of obtaining the raw materials and producing things for that sort of energy system, and also in terms of the energy return on energy investment, and I'm wondering if you could talk about the limitations of those renewable alternative energies a bit.
Yeah, well, that material is present in more depth in that study I spoke about earlier, which is available on this website right here, Searching for a Miracle. Basically, the most important limitations with those renewables are intermittency. The sun isn't always shining, the wind isn't always blowing. So finding a way to store that energy or to distribute it across long distances so you can balance out loads adds substantial extra cost down the line in with renewable energy sources. Now, is that a reason not to do it? Absolutely not. We have to build out renewable energy infrastructure as much as we can, as fast as we can. But, you know, given these limitations, we have to understand it's going to be expensive and it's going to take a lot of effort, and we're not going to be able to replace fossil fuels on a one-to-one basis. It's going to be a completely different kind of economy. It's going to be a much more localized economy. With fossil fuels, you know, whether you live in South Africa or Alaska or China, if you're driving a car, you're driving a car with gasoline in the tank, most likely, or maybe diesel. And it may have come from Saudi Arabia or Iran or Venezuela. Who knows? It's all fungible at all. It's all one world global oil market. With renewables, you know, it's going to be a matter of what do we have available in this region. You know, San Francisco can operate on tidal power to a very large extent. Kansas City can't. Some places have wind, some places have lots of sun, some places have lots of hydro potential. So it's a matter of designing a renewable energy infrastructure that's right for a particular location. So it's a different way of thinking from how we have thought about energy in the past. Two more questions, okay.
Go ahead.
Thanks, John. Two quick comments, and relates to your point about local activism around the coal issue here in Alaska. If you guys are interested in more information about the issue of coal in Alaska, the website alaskacoal.org is a great place to find info there. And you can certainly tap into the network of activism that's going on to local issues specific to Kirby Spangler's comment about the one up in the valley. You can sign up at coalcommittee@gmail.com for more information there. Other quick comment on the positive side, solutions side, energy efficiency. Since we're so far behind here in Alaska, we have a long ways to catch up, which is actually an advantage for us. There's a study on the Alaska Conservation Foundation website or Alaska Conservation Alliance website that helps show how we can achieve 50% energy efficiency by 2025. And that's, I think, a great place to start, as you mentioned, so thank you for that. My question, and you can lobby some of your utility board members. I won't name exactly anybody, but someone sitting right here that might be influenced by that. The question I have for you is, with the limits that are natural and man-made in the world that we've got, for China and other heated Asian countries, do you have a forecast of when they're going to be turning the corner on some of their expansion, whether it's the infrastructure expansion or just the coal expansion that's going on over there?
Well, China's coal production is probably peaking within the next 5 years. That's my best guess at this point. It's very difficult because to make a very exact forecast, but almost certainly within the next 5 years. And that means that either China's economy will start to cool off and contract at that point, or they may be able to push it for a few more years on the basis of coal imports, but not for very long. As I said earlier, just 3 years of growth at current rates could soak up all the world's current coal export market. So what do you do in year four? No more growth. I wouldn't be surprised, in fact, to see China's economy hit the wall even sooner, but I wouldn't necessarily forecast that.
Thank you.
Hello.
Last question.
She can ask it.
Okay. Two last questions.
Okay. Okay. I'll go. First of all, I'd really like to thank you for coming up here. Welcome to Alaska, and I hope you're. Stay here, however short it is a really good one. Hope
you
get a chance to go out and look around a little
Thanks
bit.
Thanks very much. Yeah,
good.
Too.
I was really struck by a number of the graphs that you showed, in particular the ones that showed a lot of asymptotic situations, right? Curves going straight up, lots of curves going straight up. Mm. I think I agree with you pretty much that we've hit the limits to growth.
toward the end of your talk, and then in some of the responses to the questions and comments, you talked about some of the reforms that need to be done, including, you know, the energy transition and the financial reparation or change, complete shift over of our financialization and financial system. At the national and international level, I wonder how likely you think that really is, given the time frames that we're dealing with. And I also wonder if you might just comment about the time frames, if we've hit the limits to growth, mm-hmm. and et cetera, peak everything, in the United States, at least.
Yeah.
You know, we've all heard this before, but
right.
we still seem to be bumbling along.
Yeah, I actually am about halfway through a book, writing a book on this subject. The book is called, will be called either The End of Growth or Life After Growth. And I have people on both sides yeah. arguing which title it should be. But if you... you can read chapters from that book as they're composed in draft form on the post-carbon and energy bulletin websites. That's not an answer to your question, though. I think the system is being held together right now with chewing gum and baling wire, in effect. These enormous stimulus packages and bailouts have just barely kept the lid on what would otherwise be rapid and catastrophic deflation. Anytime you have trillions of dollars disappearing from an economy, that is inherently deflationary. And many people are afraid, on the other hand, that we're going to see hyperinflation because the Federal Reserve is creating all of this new money through quantitative easing. What's actually happening is that a very uneasy, I wouldn't say balance, but kind of... a lid has been put on the kettle, and the kettle is still boiling, and the lid could come off at any time. I think we have at most 10 years before a very, very serious currency crisis, but it could come much, much sooner. I mean, even what's going on right now with this mortgage foreclosure crisis, you know, where the banks are finding out that they can't foreclose on all these mortgages because the paperwork was never done properly, and it wasn't actually done properly on purpose because it saved the banks from paying a lot of taxes and so on. And in fact, if you look at it closely, it's a form of fraud and racketeering. But of course, we don't want to get put too fine a point on it because then that would cause the banks to collapse. So, you know, we maybe need a little bit more baling wire and chewing gum to fix that problem. I don't know. But at any time between now and maybe 10 years from now, we are going to see a very, very serious currency crisis. That's the best I can say.
And I'm going to hold this. My question actually comes from the fact, and by the way, welcome to Alaska, and have you gone outside of the urban part of our state?
I have not been able to. The
okay.
nicest view I've gotten so far was from the airplane window.
And yes, and I know, and what I hope is that you actually can come to see the rest of Alaska. And we have in the rest of Alaska two really amazing things. And one of them is natural resources that are renewable, that are absolutely astounding levels. They exist, and throughout those areas where there are amazing ways to make renewable energy, they can actually be done locally. They actually have communities throughout them. We've got 200 and some small communities around our state. And how many people from rural Alaska happen to be here? Not very many. My husband and I, and this is part of my job as an elected official, pardon me, and I don't think, are there any other elected officials here?
Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you. I'm a minority. This is the way it will work.
Indeed.
But what I have found, and my husband has found it as well, is that in the 64 communities I've gone through to so far, and I've been looking at the health issues, but I always talk to the town governments, and they all have plans to try to build their economy locally. And many of them that we've seen are working on renewable things that are alternatives. They're not your standard. And our state also has another amazing resource, and that is that we have an amazing number of people in our state that have as their heritage having lived here for thousands and thousands of years, thousands and thousands. 10,000, I've heard some people even say as much as 20. They've gone through all of the climate change, and they lived on this state sometimes with longer periods of longer ages than the people that were living on the planet got to, and they had these enormous energy costs, and it was their technology that kept them alive. It's amazing what we have here. Have you seen this in other parts of the world, where people have actually taken advantage of the resources that they have? We have them. We could. We need to have people elected who are ready to make sure that we actually pay attention, get to know. Most of these people say there's very few people in the government that actually come to talk to them. And I think very few people in Alaska go to those places to really get to know what's there. But have you talked to that, and give us a source where we can get the information and not have it take much time?
That's an interesting question. It's not an easy one to answer. You know, strangely enough, my first impression of Alaska is oddly reminiscent of my impressions of New Zealand. And I don't know why that is, because they're obviously very different places in very different parts of the world, but both with lots of renewable energy opportunities, both with rich indigenous heritage to draw from, and both with low population relative to land area, and both very interesting places from the standpoint of you know, folks who think for themselves and just like to, you know, have the space in which to be who they are. So I don't know if that's helpful at all, but just my impressions. Well, thank you all so much for sticking around for the full show, and look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Good night.
You've been listening to author and energy expert Richard Heinberg on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. You can listen to the question and answer portion of the program, which immediately followed Richard's talk, on our website, kska.org. Richard Heinberg speaking on Building Resilient Communities was recorded at the annual Bioneers in Alaska Conference in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on Saturday, October 16th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.